Okay, well, we have just over 15 minutes to see if there's any questions or any queries about what's been said in the course of the day. I've already got one, or even just comments, by the way. Yeah, okay.
I'm energised by your reformulation of Meta as a way of seeing things as a friendly eye.
Yep.
Instead of being seen for loving kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And I also struggle with it when it comes to the idea of sending matter, because to me, loving kindness falls on the vertical of the thing that could be quantified and matched up.
Mm-hmm.
And a mode of being on outlook to somebody else.
You don't. That's, the simple answer is in the early text, you don't. This is a way of speaking, of sending metta, that's grown up in the history of Buddhism. It's not there in the early text. It's very much based on the Hindu idea, all of that stuff. Basically, I mean, to cut a very big story very short, Buddhism at a certain period, particularly after the Buddha's death, and actually to a certain extent in his own lifetime, has become slightly what we would now refer to as Hinduized, but it's sort of more Brahmanized. And those ideas of, you know, sending things in those early cultures. And so we have this now idea now of sending metta. You don't send metta. Metta is an orientation of the mind. It's a wish. Yeah, you can wish people well. And that's exactly what you're doing. Then may all beings be happy. Yeah. May they be free from pain. May they be free from suffering. You don't send that. It's an orientation of your mind. And the other thing to remember, even if you could send it, it doesn't affect the other person. It doesn't affect the other person at all. It's really, really, the development of metta is about the orientation of your own mind. Yeah. You know, you can be developing, you know, as one of our categories, we've only done one category today, but as one of the categories is a difficult person, you know. That difficult person, no matter how much metta practice you might do, might remain a difficult person. Let's be realistic about this. But the point is, your orientation, not necessarily theirs, but your orientation might radically change towards that person. As a result of that, there might be the spin-off that their orientation changes. But don't bet on it. Don't hold your breath, is what I would say. So actually in the early texts there isn't that idea of sending metta. It's a good wish, and it's an orientation of your mind. That's what we're doing. So that's a kind of response to your question. Yes. Please, and then
I got a bit stuck on, I mean, I've obviously heard lots of different things like, you know, may you be safe, or may I be safe, may I be happy, and all those things. And I really liked your ones, except the middle one, which was may I be peaceful. I started to get, my mind started to go, but I don't want to be peaceful, I want to be excited. But I always had that problem also with may I be happy, because I thought, well, of course you're not happy all the time. Why can you, you know, and I know even the same ones with may I be, or may you be healthy, or, you know, any of the one, I liked all your ones, except, well, it doesn't matter if I did or not, maybe what I'm really asking is, how important is it? Because, of course, my mind got very obsessed with the middle one.
Well, the first thing to notice is, isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting what the mind does,
yes,
even just those fairly basic phrases? Yes. May I be peaceful? No, I don't want to be peaceful.
Yeah. When I'm going to sleep.
Exactly. I mean, on the one hand, in a sense, that's a response.
Ah.
You know? I said, you know, drop them in as an experiment, see what happens. You've got a response. That's the response. So there's something agitating against that sense of peacefulness with that. Now, ultimately, whether you continue to work with that phrase is entirely up to you, obviously. There's many, many different phrases you can use. Most of them are drawn. You don't find, actually, if you go to the early text, you don't find a thing where the Buddha says, actually just use these phrases. All of these phrases are generally drawn from bits of the text where they're uttered by the Buddha at some point. In the course of the commentaries, they put them together in various ways. And so it's kind of pick and mix, it's pick and choose. I actually say for people who are doing this as a long-term practice, try and find something you can work with along for a long time. Something that isn't necessarily watering it down so it becomes, you know, anodyne, so that you can, you know, you feel that you're, you know, it doesn't doesn't create any friction. Sometimes it's good to have that little bit of friction to see what's happening, because actually, I mean, that's showing you an aversion, actually, to the idea of peacefulness. And no matter how you interpret it, you know, may I be happy? Well, I mean, I actually don't use that phrase personally, because it means so many things to so many different people. You know, happiness is, might be for some people going out hunting. Yeah, I just don't think it's personally a useful phrase, and there's too much talk about that. But you know, find phrases that work for you. Translate them in your own language eventually as well. You know, may I be safe and protected. You know, if that doesn't work for you, find a way of saying something similar in words that work for you. And as I said right at the beginning, you know, for those whose language might not be first language, might not be English, try and translate it into your own language. Find ways of doing with it. So it's not absolutely written in stone that you have to use these phrases. But I find that really interesting, that happened with you. Yeah. I wouldn't dismiss that. I mean, it might be, given that response, it might be worth working with that for a while. Yeah. I mean, what is so interesting about that, and this is why I say it's not about generating a particular emotion, is actually using phrases to see what happens. Because given the degree of self-criticism often in our culture, it's strange, but you know, even phrases like "May I be safe and protected," sometimes for some people actually has a response of "Actually, I don't deserve that." Yeah. At a real gut level, you know, not even a sort of intellectual level, but a real gut level that I don't deserve that, I couldn't possibly be like that. You know, so that's what you're working with. It's your body felt response to some of this. Yeah. And some of that might be aversive, and that's what you're working with. Yeah, and then.
So I very much enjoyed gently getting closer to whatever was going on today, and I just wanted to ask, on those occasions where maybe you forgot to unhook from the train and you're at the destination, whether it's intense craving or intense aversion, I've also come across the idea of skillfully redirecting your attention if it's just too intense to sit with whatever's going on. But is that, you know, maybe going out for a walk in nature or sort of nourishing yourself, but is that sort of hindering the process of acceptance?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it's worth mentioning one thing here that people get a very big misconception about in relationship to mindful practices in general, which is the idea of what I would call sitting with the unacceptable. Yeah. Sitting with something that is just so painful. I hear this in bad popular distortions of mindfulness. All you've got to do is sit with it. And that's the kind of advice that people get. Just sit with it. Actually, in a lot of cases, that's really bad advice. Really bad advice. You know, if it's so painful, if it's a trauma or something like that, you do not want to sit with it. The Buddha actually gives lots of different ways of redirecting your mind. You know, he says sometimes you simply have to protect the mind. I mean, one form of mindfulness is protection of the mind. You know, not saying never, but saying actually not now. I'm just too raw to confront this. Okay, I'll go away and look at the body. I'll go away and look at something else. The breath, whatever, you know, sounds. But take yourself away from that experience. Yeah. So redirecting the mind is fine. It's not a cop-out. You know, that's the trouble, is people think it's a cop-out. You know, and again, that's that sort of, oh, if it isn't painful, it's somehow not working. Some things are just too damn painful, aren't they? Really are. But, you know, particularly if it's fresh and it's raw, sometimes even if it's a long historical thing that you've carried with you for a long time, you might need a lot of support in other areas to help you to come to that thing. And that even that might be gradual over a period of time. So I think, you know, it's fine. It's fine if it really, really is painful. Only you will know that. Yeah. If you happen to have the opportunity of working with the teacher, they might be able to help you to explore how intensely painful that is. But actually, really, you will know it. Yeah. And know whether you know, I'd say, actually, not now. Okay. There's a question.
I really like the idea of becoming friends with yourself, and it comes as an enlightenment to me. It's something very new. Because
right.
I find that very often I judge myself so much. I'm so unfriendly to myself. And very often when I approach a problem, if that was someone else, I would be so much more kinder. I would just hug them and say, it's okay. And to myself, I'm an emotion, have it on an emotion, etc. So how do you start to become a friend with yourself? How do you work with these things?
It's a gradual process, of befriending yourself. I mean, sometimes it can be done through acts, simple acts of kindness. Knowing, for example, not to push yourself if you don't have to, when you're tired. Looking at the self-critical mechanism, which is so, as I said, so embedded in most of us that we kind of lacerate ourselves with that. Looking at that and saying, okay, fine, but I don't have to trust you. You know, it's actually the other thing, and you're just doing it, is actually develop a smile and a sense of humour about some of it as well. Yeah, I don't know, I mean, it probably doesn't strike most people a lot of the time as being, but sometimes isn't it just humorous when you see the same stuff come around again, and when you're being critical in the same ways as you've been for years. You know, I think it ought to be part of every meditator's kind of toolbox, is a reasonable sense of humour about it. Because I don't know if you notice, and I'm being, and there's always something serious about humour here, which is that the humour punctures the balloon of pomposity.
What?
Because there's a kind of pompousness to the idea of, you know, I've got to be hard on myself, I'm being critical with myself, I'm, you know, got to be tough, you know, and all that sort of stuff go. Watch it deflate a little bit. Now, these are ways, there's very practical ways of doing it. I'd start with just simple acts of kindness. Just looking at your own physical, mental responses, your own tirednesses, your own, you know, the demands that you make on yourself, and sometimes just saying, okay, I'm going to ease off a little bit. Just start with little things like that and look at those self-critical mechanisms and see the self-criticism, you know, just as a thought. We have this phrase that some of you will know, particularly those who are involved in mindfulness-based applications. We have this phrase, I think it's a lovely phrase, which is, thoughts are not facts. Yeah, even if it's the most critical thing, it's not a fact about you. It's just a thought. And that's a really useful way of just distancing yourself a little from it. Yeah. And being able to hold it slightly differently. Because in the end, what we're not trying to do is we're not trying to go out with a gun and zap all the bad thoughts. What we're trying to do is just come into a different relationship where we don't take them so seriously. They're a bit like spoiled children, a lot of these thoughts. You know, the more attention you give them, the worse they get. You know, the less, you know, the more you withdraw some of the attention from them, the less... the less kicking and screaming they do. So then kind of just take it slowly, just little by little, just in those little acts, one a mental act and the other physical acts, you know, just giving yourself a little easier time about it. Please.
I think it's probably quite a big question, but it keeps coming to me all the time. Animals know how to be. Why do you think it is that the human mind is so unevolved that we are struggling with these basic elements of how to deal with our anxieties and fears of thoughts and just deal with them in a way that, you know, in the mindfulness way and just be properly in the world? Is it a historic, is it a cultural thing? Is it a, it's just the, it just strikes me with physically we're so evolved to adapt in the world, and the human mind is just. Why is it like that?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of a lot of things. There's a huge evolutionary dollop in there. You know, the brain is set up to do this. I was talking a little bit yesterday, you know, for example, that the brain is actually set up with a negative bias. So, for example, negative phenomena, because of evolution, imprint naturally into the brain because you needed that for survival. Yeah. Now, to actually remember positive phenomena, good things that have happened to you, you actually have to hold them in mind. It's about for 15 or 16 seconds. for them to actually imprint. Now, I'm sure all of you, and I'm saying that because it's a very simple example, I'm sure all of you can think about all of the bad things that have happened in relationships, in things that have just gone on holidays, and just ordinary mundane stuff. You can probably all recall something negative. It's really difficult, isn't it, to actually pull out good stuff. And that's because the negative stuff imprints immediately on the brain. So a huge amount of it is evolutionary stuff. The brain is set up in certain ways, and they're sort of neurological mechanisms which actually account for a lot of the difficulty I think we have in changing. The one thing we do know from kind of contemporary neuroscience, of course, with neuroplasticity, is the actual that the brain can be reconfigured in different ways, but it takes training and it takes time to do that. Some things are really deeply programmed into the brain, really deeply programmed, without going into details, really deeply programmed into the brain, and it takes a long time. For me, this is very heartening, because it actually shows why the Buddha is saying, without knowing any of that stuff, this is difficult. It's not easy. It doesn't just happen. And a lot of it's cultural. A lot of it's linguistic. Yeah? A lot of language and culture go together as well, and they are really influencing. I mean, so much so that the German philosopher Heidegger says, you don't speak language, language speaks you. it's speaking you constantly as a particular being. You know, his is the German language, it might be ours is the English language, and they bring cultural phenomena with it, and attitudes of mind and ways of approaching things. Christian Judaic culture, for example, brings in certain mental attitudes. Which in a Buddhist context seem really odd, often to Asians who come out of those Buddhist contexts, seem really odd. I mean, guilt is a really odd concept to most Asians, because, if you take any Indic language, there's no word for guilt at all. They had to invent it, by the way. The Christian missionaries had to invent a word for guilt to give them it. Here's a little present, guilt.
They have remorse,
though.
They have shame.
They have shame. They have shame. Yeah. There's a distinction anthropologically between shame cultures and guilt cultures. Yeah. Asian cultures tend to be shame cultures, whereas Western cultures tend to be guilt cultures. Not saying one's better than the other, it's just different, and it programs us differently to respond differently to those things. So all of these factors, it's a huge mix of factors that's operating. And what we're, in a sense, is beginning to look at some of that stuff. Yeah, we're beginning to look at that stuff. We're starting to reprogram the brain neurologically by starting, even to what we've been doing today is the start of programming your brain neurologically. Yeah, to set up new neurological pathways in the brain by acting with friendliness, beginning to act with friendliness. And then there's all the other cultural stuff that comes up for examination. Most of it, I might say, is pretty innocuous. It doesn't really matter. Some of it actually is very good. Etiquette and manners and all these sort of things to help interrelations with people and for us to operate within this without rubbing each other up the wrong way. Those are very, very good. They're very they're worth examining, but one doesn't have to abandon it all. But this is what we're beginning to look at. We're looking at, in a sense, the way we're programmed a lot of the time, and that's why it's so difficult. The brain itself is very peculiar. I'll just say this and then we must finish, because I saw Andrea waving a watch at me. There's a neuroscientist I know in America who actually said to me, the perfect argument against things by design, the argument by design, is the brain. Because if anybody designed a brain, they would not design it this way. it's just evolved this way. You would not design it that way. Anyway, all I can say is thank you very much, everybody, for your day's practice. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, John.